This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
The decades after World War II were a golden age across much of the world. It was a time of economic miracles, an era when steady jobs were easy to find, and families could see their living standards improving year after year. And then, around 1973, the good times vanished. The world economy slumped badly, then settled into the slow, erratic growth that has been the norm before the war. The result was an era of anxiety, uncertainty, and political extremism that we're still grappling with today. And that's the subject of a new book called An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Postwar Boom, and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. And joining me on the program for a special edition is its author, Mark Levinson. Mark, from an economic point of view, the second half of the 20th century, you divided into two periods, one after World War II and the second period from 1973. I guess my question is, what characterizes these two periods and why these two periods were chosen? In other words, what separated the two and why were they broken in that way?
Jim, they were broken in that way because the economic performance at the time was distinctly different. If you take a look at the data, not just for the United States, but for really all the wealthy economies, Western Europe, Japan, Canada, in the period between 1948 and 1973, you had very rapid economic growth driven by very rapid productivity growth, and people's living standards improved steadily through that period. It was really an extraordinary time, as I call it. After 1973, things were quite different. You had much slower economic growth. Productivity growth fell very significantly, and people felt like they were crawling ahead. They didn't feel like they were really moving ahead. And that had some political ramifications we can talk about. In the first part of this period, the 48 to 73 period, the economy around the world was robust almost everywhere, almost all the time. And that hasn't been the case at all since 1973.
What was behind that torrid growth rates that we saw after World War II up until 1973, Mark? Because that growth, as you mentioned in your book, and of course, politicians have always accused the other side of poor economic growth, even including this election. What was behind that torrid growth? Because we haven't been able to duplicate it.
Well, of course, some of this was due to rebuilding from the war. Obviously, you had a lot of work to do there. But a lot of this growth was due to one-time factors that were really very important in improving productivity after the war. I can give you just some examples of that. People forget now, but at the time of World War II, there were a lot of people around with very little education. We had many workers in this country who had fifth or sixth grade educations, an even larger percentage in Europe. Well, we spent heavily on education in the years after World War II, and in short order, built ourselves a much more educated, much more literate workforce, able to do much more complicated kinds of work. At the time of the war and its immediate aftermath, the agricultural industries, again, around the world, were really quite primitive by modern standards. Just one data point, in the United States after World War II, we still had 3 million mules being used to plow farms. We had a lot of surplus labor in agriculture all over the world, and much of that labor could be moved into manufacturing. Instead of walking behind mules, people were tending expensive machines that could produce a lot more goods in the span of an hour. And so we saw enormous productivity growth from that. And we had some major changes in transportation. We built motorways, the interstate highway system in the United States, so manufacturers could get their goods to market faster. Workers could commute across a broader labor market. They had a better choice of jobs because it was possible to get there with the freeways all over the place. And so all of those things contributed to really significant productivity growth in the years after the war. That was all low-hanging fruit. And the problem was that we exhausted it. We took advantage of those things. So that doesn't mean that this has stopped. We're still improving our average education. But going from semi-literate workers to workers with high school education, as we did in the 50s and 60s, is a lot more significant than adding a few months or another year to the average worker's education, which is what we're doing now. So we've taken advantage of this big productivity pop, and the options that are available to us now are just not as significant in terms of what they'll do for economic growth.
Now, you cite multiple factors that cause this downshift in growth. Number one, we saw the cost of energy, especially I can remember the 70s, the oil embargo when the price jumped, population growth has slowed. You mentioned productivity. Was it a combination, Mark, of factors, or was there one in particular behind the cause of decline?
You know, at the time, everyone assumed this had to do with oil. The United States was enveloped in an oil crisis, and so were many other countries. And it was assumed that the very sharp recession and then the slow growth that followed were related to oil. But that was really not the case. The factor here was really the slower growth in productivity. And what we've had since then is a series of governments in the United States and, again, in all the other wealthy economies trying to do this and that and the other thing to rev up productivity growth so that their countries could get back to the very fast economic growth rates after the war. And that really hasn't worked anywhere. We had countries such as France, which elected a socialist government to try and improve productivity by nationalizing industry. Well, that didn't work. We had Ronald Reagan in the United States, Margaret Thatcher in the UK. They promised to improve productivity by lowering tax rates and reining in government. Well, that didn't work either. Productivity was not higher in the Reagan era and the Thatcher era than it had been before. So they were really not able to bring the economy back to where it had been during the good times.
You cite in your book something that kind of struck me. In the 1990s, there was an American academic who revolutionized thinking about economic growth by positing the idea that innovation and knowledge matter far more than labor and capital. But he admitted in 2015 that his growth theory made no scientific progress towards a consensus.
Well, this is an economic policy problem. I think everyone would agree that innovation is very important to economic growth. And the economist Paul Romer, whom you referred to, has made a career out of pointing that out. And he's right, okay? The problem here is that we don't really know how to get from innovation to economic growth. There's some things government can do to encourage innovation, okay? We can put money into the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. We could spend more on universities and give scholarships to doctoral students in the engineering and the sciences. All of those things might lead to innovations. But the evidence is very strong that innovation by itself doesn't matter to the economy. What matters is how innovations are put to use, how innovations let businesses do their business in different ways. And for whatever reason, the innovations in recent years have in general had a smaller effect on business than some of the innovations in earlier years. None of the recent innovations has measured up to, say, bringing electricity into factories, which happened around the United States heavily in the 1920s, or introducing telephone communication, or things like that. So we just have not had the economic impact from many of these innovations that we thought we'd have.
Yeah, as we take a look at this, the last several decades, there's been a tendency to ascribe causality to factors that are basically within the control of national government, whether it's taxes, tariffs, welfare. How much power does government actually have to stimulate economic growth?
Well, you know, this is a conundrum. Everyone who runs for office in a democratic country accuses his or her opponent of policies that are making unemployment too high and economic growth too small. And everyone who runs for office says, I've got a better idea. I can give you faster economic growth. But economic growth comes from productivity growth. And when you get into the Oval Office or 10 Downing Street or wherever your government is seated, there's no button on the desk that you can push to give you faster productivity growth. Most of the factors behind productivity growth come from the decisions of private businesses to embrace new technology, to embrace new business processes, to put new ideas to work in a profitable way. And those things happen unpredictably. They can't just be ordered up.
So when you take a look at this period, let's say leading up to 1973, you talk about the rebuilding of Europe, Japan, and the driving force, which was this technological advancement, which offered very efficient ways for workers to do their job. What do you think really changed productivity after 1973? I mean, because we've had technological development. You just take a look at what we've done, gosh, in just the last decade alone. Our smartphones, our tablets, social media. We've had all these advances, and yet we failed to increase productivity.
We didn't fail to increase productivity exactly. It's just that productivity growth has been pretty slow. And these things are unpredictable. It's not a satisfactory answer for people, but it's true. I'll give you an example from some of my own work. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Box, which is a history of container shipping and its economic consequences. Most of the work to develop container shipping was done in the 1950s and 1960s. And then suddenly in the 1980s, we saw huge economic changes as business adopted modern logistics strategies. They sprouted global supply chains. All of those things came 20 or 30 years after the development of containerization. So this progress doesn't happen in any predictable way. It takes businesses a long time to work through these changes, to see what advantage they can get from them, and to bring that benefit into the economy. We saw the same thing with computers. You may recall that in the late 90s, we got a brief bump in productivity growth for 3 or 4 years, and that resulted in a bump in economic growth. The unemployment rate dropped to levels which were lower than they'd been for many years. Why did that happen? That seems to have been the fruit of investments in computing technology that happened in the 50s and 60s. And it took decades before the productivity effect of those investments showed up in the U.S. economy.
You know, something else that also changed, I think, after 71, 73, there was this understanding of fiscal responsibility up until that time. It was supplanted with the idea that budgets, which used to be balanced, government deficits became tolerable, desirable, especially when it comes to, for example, periods of high unemployment. And you take a look at the U.S. today, a new president will assume office in January. He'll inherit $20 trillion. So what caused this change? It seemed like deficit spending, changes in monetary policy, all these little levers that government tried to use to drive the economy. What made that more acceptable after 1973? Because it's now standard government policy.
One of the things that made life better for so many people in the decades after World War II, the period I call in my book the Golden Age, was that we really had the growth of a welfare state around the world. This was the period in which many governments created or raised benefits for pensioners, what we call Social Security here. During this period, many governments created family grants so that families with children would get extra money. They improved disability insurance programs. They provided greater education or free scholarships for students without the income to go to the university. There were a lot of aspects to these welfare programs that made life more stable and less volatile for many people. Those programs were possible financially because very rapid economic growth meant very rapid growth in tax revenue. So governments could afford to do those sorts of things. Well, after 1973, slower economic growth meant slower growth in tax revenues. And all of a sudden, these welfare programs began to be seen as a burden. You didn't have people saying how great it is to have these benefits. You had people complaining about how much taxes were going up to finance these benefits. And the social spending has taken on a larger and larger share of total government spending in most economies. As governments have tried to keep these social benefits, tried to keep people happy, tried to maintain a very basic part of their living standards. But the cost of these benefits has in many cases grown more rapidly than the economies. So they've just consumed a larger share of tax revenues. This is a problem we see in many countries at this point. It's not unique to the United States. And it really has to do with a social welfare system that was shaped for a different era. It was shaped for an era when very rapid economic growth was the norm.
You know, one thing that did change after at least 1971 is the dollar was at one time backed by gold, and this sort of handcuffed politicians. Since then, the dollar has been based on a confidence and faith in the U.S. and economic growth in this system. How much of a role did moving off the gold standard, did that play any role in terms of economic growth?
Moving off the gold standard clearly made certain parts of the economy more volatile, as exchange rates fluctuate a lot more than they did back in the 50s and 60s. So to that extent, moving off the gold standard has had some effect. On the other hand, moving off the gold standard made it possible to have more rapid growth in the money supply without worrying about inflation if there was no inflation. So I think we've seen, for example, in recent times, the central banks have been able to accommodate growth without worrying about how many dollars an ounce of gold will buy. That said, there are many people out there who believed back in the 80s and still believe today that they have some special secret that is going to rekindle economic growth, that's going to stabilize the economy and bring us greater productivity. Some of those people believe in the gold standard. Some of those people believe that we need a simple monetary supply rule of the sort that Milton Friedman used to believe. Some of those people believe that we need a balanced budget. There are all kinds of notions about what is going to restore economic growth and productivity growth to the earlier levels. My own view is that nothing is likely to restore economic growth and productivity growth to the earlier levels, and that the people who promise us otherwise are selling soap.
You know, something else that we saw rise in the 1970s, and that was the birth of environmentalism. And it began with, as you cite in the book, the limits to growth. Today, the environmental movement has gained popularity among the population. It's now about climate change. We've seen myriad regulations that have come in as a result of it. Did that play any role in changing economic growth?
Yes, and I need to say here that when we measure economic growth, we're talking about something like the gross domestic product, GDP, in the United States. And GDP doesn't capture everything that goes on in the world. So it is a perfectly valid criticism to say that in the 50s and 60s, we were all concerned about GDP and didn't really worry about the environmental damage that resulted from having certain industries and certain activities. That's an absolutely fair criticism. That said, we've had environmental regulation now since the late 60s or early 70s, and a certain amount of investment that would go to other things goes to environmental protection, whether it's making better landfills or putting scrubbers at power plants or other types of investment. And on balance, that's probably had some effect on slowing down the rate of economic growth. I don't know that it's been a great effect. I'm not sure it's been hugely significant. I'd also point out that the trend towards slower productivity growth is worldwide. Countries have many different types of regulations. They don't all follow the United States. And so the fact that productivity growth here is slower than it used to be doesn't let you conclude that it's all the result of some particular EPA regulation you don't like, because another country may have no similar regulation and also be suffering from productivity growth. I think sometimes we focus too much on ourselves and we don't look enough at what's going on around the world.
Yeah, one of the premises of the environmental movement in a complaint that polluting more could make the economy seem to grow faster. But out of that belief came a false conclusion that economic growth was merely a fiction, or worse, that prosperity was the enemy.
Well, I remember when the Limits to Growth was published. The Limits to Growth, for your listeners who don't recall, was a book that purported to show that the world economy was headed to collapse. We were using too much copper, too much iron, too many trees. This growth rate was unsustainable, and within a few years, it would totally collapse. This book, which was published in the early 70s, was based on what were purported to be some computer models. It was very fancy for the day in making use of computer modeling. It didn't have much data behind it, which was one of its problems, but it was definitely apocalyptic. The Limits to Growth sold 12 million copies around the world, and it led people to believe that the world was indeed on the verge of economic collapse. It didn't really allow for adaptation, for the fact that when prices of something go up, people stop buying it and use something else. People invent new goods and services. People have new ways of doing business. And so that kind of extrapolation didn't make any sense, but that didn't mean it wasn't popular. And it helped build a constituency of people who think economic growth is a bad thing. There are still some people around like that today. I think that most of us, you know, like to have jobs and earn income, think economic growth is important. And the question is not how to stop it, but how to make sure we do it in an environmentally responsible way.
I want to talk about something that also came out of the 70s as a result of, as we left gold with monetary policy, we ran into the stagflation of the 70s, and there was an economic theory called the Phillips curve, which there was a trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And even today, Janet Yellen, I know, as chairman of the Fed still follows that Phillips curve. Do you think that's valid, and what impact does it have on economic growth? Because one would assume with more people employed, that's more people earning wages, that's more dollars in GDP, and yet there's, according to this model, there's a trade-off that you have to make. You have to trade that for higher inflation.
Jim, one of the things that you have to do when writing history is try and put yourself in the mindset of people at the time. And in my book, An Extraordinary Time, I'm really trying to do that. People don't recall what the discussions were at the time and how that led us in some strange directions. And the Phillips curve was definitely at the heart of one of those discussions. The argument in the Phillips curve is that there's a permanent trade-off between unemployment and inflation. So if you want low unemployment, you just have to accept higher inflation. That has pretty conclusively been shown to be false. At the moment in the United States, we've got quite low inflation and low unemployment as well. I think that most economists would say that the Phillips curve is relevant really only over a very short time period, that beyond a matter of a few months or maybe a year, unemployment and inflation really have nothing to do with each other. If you've got productivity growth, then your economy can expand, it can create new jobs, and that expansion won't be inflationary. I think today we tend to regard inflation as mainly a monetary phenomenon. It's something that the central bank deals with. That wasn't the case in the 70s either. Your older listeners may recall that we used to talk about different kinds of inflation. We talked about demand pull inflation as if it were different from cost push inflation, as if that were different from monetary inflation. And each of these things had a different remedy. Going back now and reading the articles about the economy in those days is very strange because we don't think like that at all now. We think about inflation as a monetary problem and we expect the central bank to deal with it. And we don't say whether we think inflation is due to higher wages or higher steel costs or higher farm product costs or whatever. That doesn't make any sense to us anymore.
You know, something else that came out of the 70s as well, we still see it in existence today. As the international system changed, the dollar wasn't backed by gold. The economic environment, we've seen these exchange rate gyrations that have led to crisis. One can think of the breaking of the pound in, what was it, 91 and 92 by George Soros. We've seen volatile commodity prices. Goodness, just look at the last decade with the price of gold and oil. And it has had an impact on the global financial system, especially what we've also seen is the introduction of leverage and derivatives. And it's been an issue that, as you talk in your book, in many cases, the regulators ignored the banks as they did and allowed them to leverage up in the last decade. And of course, we just came through the major financial crisis. So how much of this also alters the growth rate? Because businesses like to have stability. investors like to have stability in the markets. And when you don't have that stability, it creates uncertainty, and that alters economic thinking as well.
I think there's something to that. What we've seen really in recent years is that governments have encouraged credit as a way to promote economic growth that wasn't occurring otherwise. They wanted to juice business investment. They wanted to juice consumer spending. How do you do that? You make it easier for businesses and consumers to borrow. And we certainly saw that in the United States. After all, this is what the subprime financial crisis was, right? This was borrowers who shouldn't have been able to borrow to buy houses, borrowing money. This is what the junk bond market has been, where you've got some of the companies in the junk bond market being serious credit risks, but they can still sell bonds. And I think there's a good argument that credit was deliberately made easy for some groups of borrowers in order to make up for the fact that we were not having much success in getting faster economic growth in other ways. Maybe if people borrow more and spend more, the economy will grow faster. That seemed to be the logic behind this. It did not end well.
I want to move on to, in your book, you talk about Japan. And coming out of the war, they adopted several things. They embraced U.S. and European technology. They made a heavy investment into capital and economies of scale. But in 1989, the Japanese stock market has peaked. It's never been back where it was in 1989. Are we in danger of becoming Japan?
I don't think that we're in danger of becoming Japan, but I think Japan has a lesson or two for us. People may remember that the Japanese government in the 70s and the 80s was very much obsessed with building Japan's manufacturing sector, making it more modern. Once the oil crisis came in 1973, the Japanese government said, we're going to be facing higher bills to import oil because Japan has no oil. And if we're going to deal with that, we need to have a big exporting sector. So the government really pushed Japanese companies to export, helped in some cases push them to export jointly or to undertake joint efforts. It made low-cost financing available for them to explore export opportunities. This is really what turned Japan into the export powerhouse that we knew in the 1980s. Well, all of the public attention went to the manufacturing sector, and none of it went to the service sector. The result was that Japan was left with an extremely inefficient service economy. It has world-class companies in some areas of manufacturing, companies that are as efficient as any in the U.S. or Europe. And then in the service sector, it's got hugely inefficient companies, places where you've got little tiny shops with two or three employees. You go into a bank and you need permission from these people and then from that other person and then from somebody else, and they all need to stamp your paper. These companies operate far less efficiently than service companies in the United States. And that very sluggish productivity growth has really retarded Japan's economic growth over the past 20 years. I think this is a problem that Japan has been slow to cope with. Some aspects of the Japanese economy are extremely heavily regulated, and that has prohibited some change that probably would have been for the better. I think that in general, we are not nearly as bad off in that sense. We're not as heavily regulated in many areas as Japan. It's easier here to get a business going. It's easier to change jobs. There are a lot of things about the U.S. economy that are more flexible. That being said, I think we do have to worry that in some sense we're getting stuck in our ways. The President's Council on Economic Advisers, for example, has called attention to the fact that a very large number of jobs in the United States now require licenses. In some states, you can't be a landscape architect or an interior decorator unless you've got a state license. These licenses keep people from moving around, keep resources from being reallocated within the economy. They're not a great idea where there's not public safety involved. We've seen evidence that it's getting harder to start a business in the United States than it used to be. This is probably not a great thing for economic dynamism. So I think there are some things we need to be concerned about, but I don't think we're nearly to the point of Japan.
You know, something you talked about, this sweeping economic transition from the industrial age to the information age, as you talk about in your book, at the end of the Golden Age was the beginning of a sweeping economic transition in which the massive industrial complexes in vogue at the time after the war basically ceased to be drivers of economic growth. In their place, manufacturers would organize dispersed networks of much smaller factories linked by an international supply chain employing even smaller number of workers. And this led to that era of well-paid factory jobs was basically over. And this was an issue in this election. In the new economy, value would come from innovation, design, and marketing, not from the physical process of turning raw materials into finished goods. So basically you were saying we moved from that industrial economy, which was slowly yielding, to the information economy. And Mark, if you take a look at today, it continues. We're seeing robots coming into the workforce at factories. For example, Amazon is coming out with a grocery store where you won't even have checkers or guys bagging groceries. You'll just use your smartphone and it'll pick up what you buy. Amazon and some stores are using robots for managing inventory and warehouses. So it is a different society, and it is more, as you say, information oriented and maybe less labor force oriented.
I think it is. This really goes back to your question earlier about the change in technology and why we're not seeing so much benefit from new technology now. If you go back into the 1950s and 1960s, we had plenty of new technology, and that technology usually served to create new manufactured goods, to create lots of new factory jobs. It was seen by the mass of people as something that, in general, was positive. Yes, there was a lot of concern back then about what would happen with automation, but the fruits of technology overall were beneficial. I think now you see a lot of cases where technology is perceived to be eliminating jobs without creating new jobs. And I think this is going to become a more serious problem politically. It's not something yet that we talk about in the political sphere. But clearly, we're not going to be having more jobs in manufacturing. We're going to be having less, even if we have more manufacturing production. Why? Because a lot of those jobs can be automated. We're not going to have more jobs in some routine office occupations. Why? Well, a lot of those things can be automated away. So I think we do have a challenge here. And it's not just an economic challenge. I think that we really make a mistake here by talking about the threat, if I can use that word, of new technology just in economic terms. Because work is important to people, not just for financial reasons, but because it gives their lives meaning. It defines people to a certain extent. This is what I am. This is what I do. And if we're going to have a situation in which a lot of people don't have work as we're accustomed to having employment, then they're also going to be lacking for an important source of meaning in their lives. I think that has some pretty obvious social consequences that we need to think about.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of these social consequences, because what we've seen coming out of the late 60s and 70s was the concept of the welfare state, both here and abroad. We saw the Great Society programs here in the U.S. You know, Mark, today 68% of the government's budget is on autopilot. That's Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt. I'm just not so sure the government has a lot of flexibility to stimulate the economy the way we used to think it would. We saw at the beginning of the millennium, George W. Bush doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Barack Obama, when he leaves office, will have doubled the national debt from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. Are we running up against limits in terms of what government can do? In other words, is this sustainable?
Let me distinguish two different things here. I don't think that the amount of our national debt at this point is an enormous problem. The interest rate on that debt is still quite low. And while the debt has definitely grown, the economy has grown. And you need to look at the debt in relationship to the economy's ability to pay it. The United States is much better off than most other wealthy economies, certainly, in the size of its debt compared to the size of its economy. So while we have a problem there, I don't think it's an urgent problem. Where I am more concerned, frankly, is what we do with the money, which is to say that, as you point out, a lot of this money really goes into benefits for older people. And I hate to say it, since I'm going in that direction myself, but older people are not the ones who are making the great contribution to productivity growth. Okay? They're not the ones who are going to create the wealth that we'd like to have to spend tomorrow. They're not the ones who are going to be able to raise our incomes. And so my concern here is that we are spending too much of our money on older people and not enough on the younger people who are going to be the source of tomorrow's economic growth. I think that's really an issue that we need to address quite seriously.
As you come to the conclusion of your book, and since the financial crisis, it's been called the new normal. Mark, maybe instead of the new normal, it's really what was normal, because that period from 1948 to 1973 was an extraordinary period of economic growth, as you describe in the title of your book, that we have not seen in ages before or much afterwards.
We'd love to have it all the time. We'd like that to be the norm, absolutely. You know, there's just some simple math that I think helps people understand this. If your economy is growing at 5% a year, then the economy doubled in size in 14 years. Okay? And so the people who are part of that economy can feel better. They know that their living standard is rising from year to year, and they can feel that in their consumption. They can feel that in better homes and in newer cars and in vacation trips and in all of those things. If your economy is growing 2% a year, it's going to take 35 years to double in size. Okay? What that means is you're getting better very slowly. Your living standard is rising at a very slow rate, and for some people, it's not rising at all. And you no longer feel that you're getting ahead. You no longer look to your kids having a better future than you've got. That's the situation we're in now. And unfortunately, historically, that's been the situation in most times and most places. Economic growth has tended to be slow. And while we would love it to be fast, while we think it ought to be fast, we have very limited ability to make that happen. I think that that's going to be an ongoing political problem for us for years and years to come, because what people would like, what they feel they're entitled to, what they want for their families, it just isn't something that governments have the ability to deliver to them.
And so is there anything that you can think of that could bring back that extraordinary time? In other words, change in technology or innovation or anything. In other words, we've had the agricultural age, we had the industrial age, now we're in the information age. Is there anything on the horizon that you could see, Mark, that would change this slow growth period that we seem to be in right now?
Let me offer two comments, Jim, in response to that. One is that the things that government can do, while they're fairly minor, they're still important. Okay, we still need to be spending money on research and development. We still need to be spending money on education. Those things may not raise productivity by 3 or 4%, but they may raise it by 3 or 4 tenths of a percent, and that's a whole lot better than nothing. So I think that those are good investments. Beyond that, I think we need to speak a bit honestly about this. We've created an expectation in our democratic societies that we just have no ability to fulfill. That doesn't mean that we won't have rapid productivity growth. It's entirely possible that we have some innovations that will lead the economy to boom again. But these are not innovations that we can predict. We don't know when they'll arrive. The government can't make them show up and be put to effective use. So look around. You see things like artificial intelligence, virtual reality. Could those kinds of technologies be the basis of a new boom? Absolutely, they could. When will it happen? I can't tell you, and neither can anyone else. That's the situation we're in. The economy is ordinary. It's likely to stay pretty ordinary. Maybe we get a shot of growth at some future time when we can't really predict it. And I think it'll be great if that happens, but don't ask me to tell you what year it'll be.
Well, maybe this ordinary time is something we're just going to have to accommodate and get used to. I think the real risk here, Mark, as you point out in your book, at times we have politicians that come forward and they promise, this election period being one of them, that if you elect me, I can bring back that golden age. And yet I've yet to see that transpire under the last couple of presidents.
Well, and this is a problem all around the world, Jim. Again, we just went through an election in the United States in which we had both leading candidates promising to speed up the economy. Not quite sure how either of them thought they were going to do it, but they both promised that. If you look across the Atlantic, Brexit was a response to slow economic growth, and there's a considerable demand to make the economy grow faster in the UK. You see the same in continental Europe. You see the same now in Asia, where there's been dissatisfaction with slow growth in Japan. You see what's going on even in Korea. Here's a case where you had an economy that went through a period of extremely rapid growth, and now it's hitting normal, and people don't like normal. Normal doesn't feel so good. So this is a worldwide problem, and it's going to be a problem in all democracies, that people really expect their living standards to rise faster than is likely to happen.
It is amazing, because every election that I can think of, unfortunately, our politicians are saying, elect me and I will make things prosperous again.
If somebody ran for office and said, I can't do that, would you vote for him?
Yeah, but elect me and things will just be ordinary. Probably not a good campaign slogan.
That's our problem.
Well, Mark, you've written a fascinating book and brought some clarity to some of the issues that we've been facing, not only here in the U.S., but around the globe today, as governments grapple with trying to deliver that extraordinary time. The name of the book is called An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Postwar Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy, by Mark Levinson, who's been my guest. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Great, Jim. Thank you very much for inviting me.
That concludes our show for this New Year's weekend. Hope everybody had a nice, safe holiday, and the best to a new year to all of you. We'll be back with our regular programming format next week as we take a look at Forecast 2017. What are the experts saying for the year ahead? We'll have a lot to talk about. Until then, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.